So just take a handout and pass it back. One of the benefits of being on the staff of a school, I'm the academic dean at the University of the Holy Land, and I have a photocopier in my house. So when Chuck called at 8 a.m. and said, you know, there's this very exciting thing happening that a baby is being born, can you speak today? Then I started, you know, I said yes. I had no idea what I would speak on. I started thinking through my already developed units of teaching material and things like that. And I had thought I would do one thing, but as we were having breakfast together, another one of our favorite portions came to the forefront of the breakfast table conversation. So I ran up and via the wonders of accordance, for those of you who have Macintosh computers or even PCs, there is a program called Accordance that gives you scripture resources in every language and every translation, every version. You can get the Mishnah and the Talmud and Josephus and Philo and geography, etc. But I simply used it to put side by side the story of the Syrophoenician woman and the story of the Canaanite woman. So now you have to take your paper and you have to fold it on the line so that we read one story at a time, because we're going to look at how each of these gospel authors tells a story of Jesus. They're both talking about the same historical event. Once in Jesus' ministry, he went to the city of Tyre. The city of Tyre is modern Tyre, where it is today in Lebanon. In the time of Jesus, of course, there was no country of Lebanon, but Tyre, that very ancient and famous city, was located in Phoenicia. This was the area of ancient Phoenicia. And before there were Phoenicians, there were Canaanites. So this region has a long history, and it has many names. Today we call it Lebanon. At the time of Jesus, they would have called it Phoenicia. At the time of Abraham, they would have called it part of Canaan. And when Jesus went to Tyre, we can assume he went there and stayed with a Jewish family or families. He stayed with part of the Jewish community in Tyre. He went there for some what we would call in American parlance R&R, rest and relaxation. He was on the verge of burnout, and so he, according to the Gospel of Mark, he went there for some rest, and while he was there, a woman, a Gentile woman, came to him and asked him to heal her daughter. And Jesus, quite extraordinarily, answered that request and healed the daughter. He delivered her of a demon, in fact. So both Matthew and Mark know the story, and they both have that historic kernel of something that Jesus did far earlier than the time that they're writing. They're writing decades later. And as they think back to that piece of information about Jesus, they want to tell it to their audience. And each gospel writer, whether it's Mark, Matthew, Luke, or John, whoever's gospel we're reading, always has a specific community in mind with real needs that they want to address. And so when they tell a Jesus story, they choose aspects that they want to emphasize or highlight because of the people that they know who will be reading the story. I think sometimes when we read the Gospels, we think that the Gospel writers are just writing everything always for everybody everywhere. But we know that all of us individually live in real communities of faith, and we are talking to other Christians all the time, and we're inviting other opinions and input. And what we even say about Jesus, we may think that we're just real objective and neutral and that this is the way it is, but actually it's informed by who we know and by what our faith community goes through. And Mark and Matthew each take that historical story of Jesus and they shape it and they tell it in a way that is meaningful for their communities at their contemporary time. But then it also has a truth that it speaks to us who actually do live 2,000 years later in a different place. And depending on where we are in life, the story can speak to us. in different ways. And maybe sometimes Mark's version will be more immediate to us, and maybe sometimes Matthew's version will be more immediate to us. And that's the beauty of having four Gospels. We have so many windows, so many views into the person of Jesus. We're not limited to just one telling of his life and his teachings and his events, but we have many windows that help us. I like the old analogy of standing on the corner. There's a car accident in the middle of an intersection, and you have four observers, one on each corner, and each one will describe the same thing to you, but because of their angle, north, south, east, west, in front, behind, to the side, they're going to see some aspects that the person on the opposite corner doesn't necessarily notice or doesn't necessarily highlight. So today I want to look at this story. This is a story that speaks of very personal encounters with Jesus. There is a desperate mother who has to take action on behalf of her child. There is a child who is never seen, but who is the recipient of God's blessing, even though she is silent and unseen and not part of the action, she experiences God's healing. There is Jesus himself, who is walking his own journey of understanding, shaping, deciding how he will be Messiah. What kind of Messiah will he be? How will he put a human face on what the God of Israel feels about his people or about all people? Does the God of Israel, the true and living God, whom Jesus is the reflection of, does that God only care about the Jews? Or is there a place in his purposes for people like the Syrophoenician woman? So we're gonna first look at Mark, and then we're gonna look at Matthew, and we're gonna see some aspects that they highlight, and hopefully at the conclusion, perhaps hear something about Jesus that will be of a benefit to all of us. So as we begin with Mark, and we see, if we were to really quickly review, I think we've done the Syrophoenician woman here before. We've done Mark's version once, but today we want to revisit her and look at the Canaanite woman. They're the same woman. As we remember what is happening in Mark, and what when you look at your page, when you open it, you'll notice there are some things that Mark tells us that Matthew doesn't, and some things that Matthew tells us that Mark doesn't, and I'll point those out to you so that they hopefully become vivid. In Mark's gospel, in the first six chapters, Mark has repeatedly emphasized the demands of Jesus' ministry. He will say things like, people crowded into the house and you couldn't even move. His family came to see him, but they couldn't get inside the house because of the crowds of people. The people followed them along the shore. Jesus gets in a boat to escape from the crowds, but the people run along the shore keeping pace with the boat. Jesus and the disciples don't have any time to eat. They don't have any time to sleep. Wherever they go, they are mobbed. Jesus is almost functioning in a 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week ministry. And the message that we get of this excitement, this intensity, this growing ministry also is showing us a person who, like Moses, is on the verge of burnout. And that's the context that leads into this the telling of the Syrophoenician woman in Mark's gospel. In fact, he says something striking, and I think many times we just sort of forget this aspect of what he says at the beginning of the story. From there he rose and went away to the region of Tyre and Sidon, so he's in southern Lebanon, Phoenicia, and he entered a house, which means he has a host, he's staying in a private home, and he would not have anyone know it. He wants to be left alone, and he wants to be anonymous. But he could not be hid. His reputation precedes him. Wherever Jesus goes, people hear about him, and they know that he's there. And immediately, okay, so where am I picturing Jesus when this particular story happens. I am picturing him in a private home. He gets there. He's inside the house. The door is closed. We can maybe picture a courtyard, you know, that you go through. And immediately a woman whose daughter was possessed by an unclean spirit heard of him and came and fell down at his feet. If I only have Mark to read and I'm reading this story, I picture a woman who is a local lady there coming into the house to find Jesus. That is very shocking to me. A stranger walks into a house that she doesn't belong in and demands to see the teacher. She came and fell down at his feet. This must be a very desperate woman to break taboos like that, to go out on a limb for the sake of her daughter. Who is this woman? Mark describes her for us. He says, "Now the woman was a Greek." Okay, she's a Gentile. "A Syrophoenician by birth, really truly a local resident, and not a Jewish resident of Phoenicia, but a Gentile resident of Phoenicia, and a woman." So we have these three markers that are telling us about this woman who on the totem pole of hierarchy, of religious authority, of acceptability to move into this situation, she has these three marks against her. She's not a Gentile. She's not a Jew. She's not a man. She's somebody who doesn't really have anything to do with Jesus. He hasn't been hanging out with the Gentiles. Not through all of his ministry up to this point in the Gospels does he even encounter Gentiles except for one healing of the Gerasene demoniac, which took place in chapter 5. There was one moment in the Decapolis. But this is quite remarkable. Is this falling down? It's okay. And very striking that this woman, who is a Gentile and from Syrophoenicia, would come in and throw herself down at the feet of Jesus in a private home when he just wants to be left alone. She begged him to cast the demon out of her daughter. We need to give this situation its full weight. This is a very serious situation. A desperate situation. A situation in which we can understand there is no other hope. Otherwise, why would this woman do this? How much courage it takes for her to walk in and confront the Jewish healer from the Galilee and present her request to him. This takes tremendous courage, and it's an act of absolute, "You are my last hope, Jesus." We don't know what her words are at the beginning of her discussion with Jesus. She just implores him to cast the demon out of her daughter. And what does Jesus say to her? He's tired. He's grappling with the fact that he's going to be the Messiah. And he says, "Let the children first be fed, for it is not right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs." Now, this is a very troublesome statement to me on the part of Jesus, because I don't like Jesus ever to not be nice to people, unless they're really, you know, Pharisees and hypocrites or something like that. Then you can say, whoa. But, you know, when religious authorities misuse religious power, then it's okay to say, whoa. But to say to a woman who comes to you in desperation because there is no other hope for her daughter, "I'm sorry, but I'm only here to take care of the children." In this case, we don't identify who the children are, but we understand that the children are the Jews. The children are the children of Abraham, the children of Israel. "I only have so much energy," he says. "I'm here to feed the children." And in fact, this is following the feeding of the 5,000. Jesus has just fed 5,000 Jews in springtime on the hillsides with bread. He's done a mosaic miracle, a Moses miracle. That miracle speaks to the fact that he is the prophet like Moses, that he is the one we should listen to. And bread runs as a metaphor through Mark's gospel at this point. And how much was there left over at that first miracle? 12 baskets full of crumbs. He says, I have to feed the children first. I have to take care of the children of Israel. It is not right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs. And dogs in any culture is an insulting thing to call somebody. For the Jews, it's insulting to be called a dog. For the Greeks, it's insulting to be called the dogs. Nobody wants to be called a dog. Dogs are not, it's not a nice thing to say to somebody. And whether you say, well, he actually says little dogs here or not, it's still a harsh thing to say to a parent who is imploring on behalf of their child. But she answered him. Now she doesn't disagree with him. She says, yes, you do have a responsibility to take care of all those children of Israel and to feed them. But, she says, and she calls him Lord, yes, sir, yes, you are my superior, and I recognize that. But, she says, even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs. Persistent. If he's going to call her a dog, she will accept that title. But then she will identify like a dog. A dog would be persistent. Has anybody ever had a dog beg for a chocolate chip cookie or a scrap of meat? Big eyes looking at you, not wanting to go away until you actually get really mean and tell the dog to go away. A dog is persistent. If it's hungry and it wants something, it's going to come and it's going to get it. And she says, all right, I'm going to be persistent like a dog and I'm going to just plead my case. Even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs. Now, Jesus' response to her is very interesting. He says to her, for this saying, you may go your way. The demon has left your daughter. That's a surprising statement, because I know probably in your mind you're thinking, Jesus says, because of your faith, your daughter has been healed. But that's not what Mark says. The word there is not faith at all. The word there is logos. For this statement that you have just made, for this understanding, for this perception, for this saying, you may go your way, your daughter is healed. What is it that she has said to Jesus that has caused him, in his tiredness, to change his mind and grant her healing? Well, the commentaries that I read, not that I thought this up, but the commentaries that I read suggest that what she has implied to Jesus is that, yes, you are the Messiah of Israel, and your job is to feed the children with bread. But as the Messiah, if you are feeding the children of Abraham with bread, should there not be a trickle-down effect of a blessing to the Gentiles as well? Don't you remember somewhere in your Hebrew Bible, Jesus, that God said to Abraham that from his seed all the nations of the earth would be blessed? Can't my daughter be part of that trickle-down effect? Can't she be a recipient of the blessing? Because you are the seed of Abraham, the Messiah of Israel. And Jesus, I think we're supposed to understand, acknowledges that that perception is true. If he is the Messiah of Israel, then his benefit should reach out to Gentiles around the world. And there is a place for them to receive the crumbs, because there's an abundance of crumbs. There's 12 baskets full of crumbs. There's enough to feed the children of Israel and more left over. And in the Gospel of Mark, as we look at this particular episode, from this point, Jesus' ministry takes a new turn, a new thrust, and he begins to go out and he feeds 4,000 with bread, and those 4,000 are Gentiles. And he begins to teach his disciples about the fact that as Messiah, he will go to the cross. That the kind of Messiah he will be a suffering Messiah, because the power of that death and resurrection will have benefit not just for the children, but also for the dogs, some of us who stand here today. So we see this very wonderful, unusual encounter between Jesus and a Gentile woman in which her persistence and her understanding that Jesus has something bigger to do is enough to compel him to grant her request, heal her child. And it's as though she is saying to Jesus, I understand that you can heal bodies. And I understand that you can heal hearts. I understand that you can deliver from demons and oppression and you can heal minds. Maybe you can also be the healer of relationships between people. Maybe in you, Jews and Gentiles will be able to come together as one. Can you heal relationships and heal my daughter? She has a bigger vision for Jesus than he might have been feeling for himself at that moment. But it's enough to feed into his life so that he is able to be refreshed, to go back, to resume his ministry in a new way that has a definite purpose in the Gospel of Mark, which is to go to the cross. Okay, so now we can open it up and we can look at what Matthew is going to do with this story. And I have to put my notes in front of me. We see when we look at the Gospel of Matthew, if you were to stop and do your gospel studies and look at their outlines, you'd find that Matthew has a very special structure to his gospel. He has, at the beginning, the infancy narrative with the genealogy. It starts with the genealogy, and there's the story of the birth of Jesus and Herod the Great, the flight to Egypt, etc. And that's like one bookend. And then at the end, he has the resurrection and the post-resurrection appearances, and he has Jesus on the mountain in the Galilee telling the disciples to go forth and make disciples of all nations, teaching everything I've commanded you. So that's the other bookend. We have two bookends. And in between the infancy and the post-resurrection commissioning of the disciples, we have like five little books, well, five big books. We have five sermons, chapter 5 to chapter 7, chapter 10, chapter 13, chapter 18, chapter 24. And before each one of those sermons, we have some stories about Jesus. You don't have to remember any of this, except to know that that Matthew, because he organizes his books into five and has these big sermons, he organizes his stories to lead into those sermons. So his chronology, his presentation is going to be slightly different than Mark's. What does he want to tell us about this encounter of Jesus with the woman? Well, the first thing we see is that we don't have the statement that Mark had about Jesus entering a house and would not have anyone know it, but he could not be hid. So if I were only reading the Gospel of Matthew today, and I didn't know Mark's story, and I wanted to visualize this, I would visualize Jesus going up to Tyre and walking around in a public place. You know, walking down the street, people are coming to hear him talk, shaking hands, buying bread. I would picture this story happening in the public sphere, not in the private sphere. Because that is where most of his healing activity took place when he was in Capernaum and in the Galilee. Things happen outdoors a lot of times. Second, we see that she is identified as a Canaanite woman. We don't have any mention of Greek or Syrophoenician. Instead, Matthew has chosen the word Canaanite, which is an archaic term. It's like if we said, about a Palestinian, instead of calling them a Palestinian, we said that person is a Philistine. Well, nobody's called Philistines today, and it's an anachronism. It doesn't make any sense in the historical context. Palestinians are Palestinians. Syrophoenicians are Syrophoenicians. Philistines and Canaanites lived a long time ago and really aren't necessarily the same people at all, right? So when Matthew says this woman is a Canaanite woman, he's using an anachronistic term that doesn't make sense in the current geopolitical situation of Lebanon at the time of Jesus. But that must mean that that term would have some kind of meaning, especially for Matthew's audience. Because why would you use the term if it wasn't going to ring some bells? Well, there are a lot of things that Canaanite can speak to. And if we think about Matthew's gospel, and we think about his genealogy, we can remember, unlike the genealogy in the Gospel of Luke, Matthew includes some women in the genealogy. In fact, he names four women in the genealogy. He mentions Tamar, the daughter-in-law of Judah, the son of Israel, of Jacob. He mentions Rahab, the prostitute in Jericho. He mentions Ruth, the Moabitess, and then he mentions the wife of Uriah the Hittite, also known as Bathsheba, but he doesn't mention her by name. All four of these women are Gentiles. Bathsheba is married to a Hittite. The chances are that she is also a Hittite, and that's one of the reasons that she is included in the genealogy. There are other reasons, but what's important for us is that two of these women are Canaanites. Tamar, remember Tamar? She's a Canaanite who married the son of Judah. Rahab is a Canaanite living in Jericho. What does the genealogy prepare the reader of Matthew for already? By bringing up Tamar and Rahab, and even by, you know, extension, Ruth, the Moabitess, we're presented with three Gentile women who are very proactive. They are women who take action and who speak out. They recognize Israel's superiority or Israel's place of primacy in God's salvation history. Judah is recognized as the descendant of Abraham to whom the land belongs. Rahab recognizes that God is sending the Israelites in to conquer Jericho. So they recognize the primacy of the Israelites of their day, but they also ally themselves with those purposes and say, take me along with you. Do the right thing in this situation. Judah has to be tricked into doing the right thing. He's going to miss the opportunity. The spies are kind of flummoxed about what to do in Jericho, and Rahab gives them a plan. So both of these women are successful Canaanite women who ally themselves with God's purposes of Israel and who encourage Israelite men to step into that particular moment of history and time and fulfill what they're supposed to be doing. So we got to say that to be a Canaanite woman is not a negative thing in the Gospel of Matthew, because we have these positive role models who have already done something. And so this Canaanite woman comes from that region and cries out, hear her language to Jesus. Have mercy on me, O Lord, Son of David. She recognizes his role as the descendant of David who will be the king of Israel, who will be the Messiah. So she puts herself already in what we would understand from Scripture to be the right line of reference. She calls him Lord. She calls him Son of David. Both of these are kingly titles. And in fact, she calls him Lord as they continue on. She says, my daughter is severely possessed by a demon. There's no mention of an unclean spirit in this particular case, just demon possession. And he did not answer her a word. Oh my gosh. She's ready to lay herself down before him, acknowledge his authority, acknowledge his rule, and he does not even respond. This is very challenging. And the disciples are annoyed by her. And they came and they begged him and said, send her away, for she is crying after us. This is similar to when the blind men are in Matthew chapter 20 are asking Jesus to heal him at Jericho, to heal them in Jericho. In Matthew, there's two men. And Jesus is ignoring them, and the disciples want these people to be sent away. But Jesus is thinking. I think he's thinking. And the reason he doesn't answer her at first is he's got to decide exactly what it is that he's going to say. And it's a moment of question for him. Do I respond to this lady or not? In verse 24, he says, "Look, I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel." And Matthew gives us in very tangible language exactly what Jesus understands his mission program to be, which is to bring the kingdom of God to the descendants of Israel, to the Jews, to bring them to a new walk with God that's personal, that is based on his rule in their hearts. And he's already said this in chapter 10 of the gospel, where he said, "I am sent to the lost sheep of the house of Israel." He sends his disciples as well. When they go out, he says, "You go out and you heal and you deliver, but don't go to the Samaritans and don't go to the Gentiles. Only go to the lost sheep of the house of Israel." I think that in Jesus' early ministry, we have to understand that in his early ministry, he did not turn to any Gentiles. He focused solely on the Jews. "But she came and knelt before him, saying, 'Lord, help me.'" Lord, help me. Great, you can help all the lost sheep of the house of Israel you want, but I am here today with my need. Lord, help me. "And he answered, 'It is not fair to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs.'" Here we see Matthew and Mark with the same response that he says. "And she said, 'Yes, Lord, but even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from their master's table.'" Mark doesn't include that word master's table, because the political implications in Mark are not as strong as they are in the Gospel of Matthew. And Matthew is pointing to a situation that echoes a history of politics, a history of relations. "You are my Lord. You are the Son of David. You are the master." "And Jesus said to her, 'O woman, great is your faith. Be it done for you as you desire.' And her daughter was healed instantly." Both stories speak so dramatically of the very personal nature of Jesus. Whether in the Gospel of Mark, where we read about this woman desperate for her daughter's healing, this woman is like Jairus, who begs for his daughter's healing. Both hopeless cases, both persistent, both throwing themselves upon Jesus' mercy, and Jesus does not turn away from them. He grants their request. In the Gospel of Matthew, this woman is like the centurion, the other Gentile, a man who comes, who says to Jesus, "I need you to heal my servant. You don't even have to come to my house. All you have to do is speak the word and he will be healed." And the centurion and the Canaanite woman in the Gospel of Matthew both speak to that absolute faith in Jesus, that he can simply say the word and their request will be granted. And both of them receive from him what they desire. In both cases, as we look at it, whether it's the perception of Jesus as having a benefit to the Gentiles, or whether it's recognizing his lordship in human history, that salvation comes first through the Jews and through the Jews to the rest of humanity, both perspectives on this healing are legitimate and valuable. And from this moment, Jesus goes out and he opens his ministry to the Gentiles. If we think for one moment about the Gospel of John, in the Gospel of John, we are not introduced to either of these miracles. John just tells seven special miracles and they're all signs. But in the Gospel of John, in chapter 12, there are some Gentiles who are interested in coming and meeting with Jesus. And they say to Philip and Andrew, "We really want to meet the teacher." And so Philip and Andrew go to Jesus and they say to Jesus, "There are Gentiles who want to come and talk to you." And Jesus doesn't talk to them at that time either. But he looks at them, and then he says to his disciples, unless a grain of wheat fall into the ground, it abides alone. But if it falls into the ground and dies, then it will spring up, and it will produce much fruit. And these encounters with Gentiles, I think for Jesus, caused him to understand in many ways that his destiny was to go to the cross. His destiny was to reach not only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel, but to Gentiles everywhere. And whether we are men or women, old or young, he still has that power to respond to our faith, respond to our perseverance and our persistence, to pray on behalf of those who are not able to pray or ask for themselves, like fathers and mothers beseeching Jesus, because he is the final, ultimate, and only answer in so many cases. Thank you.